Thank you for dialing us up or tuning us in or whatever it is you have to do to hear this 25-cent radio program. I'll tell you about, I have a guest coming up in about half an hour. I'll tell you about it in a second. But last Thursday, I don't know how many people saw this, it was reported in the Detroit News. 11 protesters were handcuffed and arrested inside the Michigan State Capitol on Wednesday, capping a day of noisy demonstrations against Governor Rick Snyder's budget bills in the legislature that opponents say are anti-union. Opponents say it. Well, anybody who can read would say that, Detroit News. Detroit News has never been really a pro-labor paper. 5 linked arms and were seated on the glass floor of the rotunda, challenging state police to arrest them, which they did. There were more demonstrations outside the building, pounding on the doors, hoping to, demonstrators outside the building, pounding on the doors, hoping to get inside. All 11 arrested will be charged with misdemeanor trespassing. Oh, I know about that. According to State Police Captain Gary Nix, one person additionally faces felony charges for allegedly breaking into the Capitol through a bathroom window and allegedly assaulting a police officer. Now, assaulting a police officer means something very, very simple. If you touch a cop, especially one who has have been assigned to crowd control or riot potential, what have you, that was made very clear to us on the bus out to Quantico. If you touch one of the people who are going to be coming at you dressed like they're ready for combat, if you touch them with your hands or inadvertently with your foot, you can be charged with felony assaulting an officer. On the other hand, the state police, the riot police, the combat suited up police who decide to move your ass out of the way because your First Amendment time is up, they're not charged with anything. The arrests capped a day when at least 3,000 demonstrators flooded the state capitol and its grounds for the biggest protest yet against the governor. This is Michigan, the governor's budget proposal, his plan to tax pensions. God damn. And efforts to weaken union bargaining rights. Snyder's budget includes a $1.8 billion business tax cut. $1,000 million business tax cut. Along with sharp cuts to spending on education and local government and taxes on pensioners. Son of a bitch. See, this has been flying under the radar, hasn't it? Did you know the 15 people or 11 people were busted inside the Michigan State Capitol in Lansing a week ago? Did you know that? I didn't. Did you? And I'm in this business. I didn't. Taxes on pensioners. The Detroit News goes on, the demonstrations mirror those in other states recently, most notably Wisconsin. Union protesters, police, firefighters, teachers, nurses, and seniors protested outside and crammed along the atrium railings inside in the Michigan State Capitol, thundering, "It's our house, it's our house." And by the way, when I talk about cops, and there might be a disparaging tone to my voice, it has nothing to do with cops on the beat. I have family member who, until he died, was in law enforcement. I have great respect for law enforcement. But when you are confronted with people who are telling you that your First Amendment zone has shrunk and your right to protest, the time has run out, the clock has run out, it's time for you to take your silly ass home and your protest banners with you, that's not, to me, the cop on the beat. That is somebody working on behalf of the corporate state. That is fascism. So, this hour is sponsored by Anonymous. Almost said his name. Yeah, you got to watch that. Anonymous says, please just call me Anonymous. If only I had more dough with which to sponsor your program. It is well worth it to hear you call out the rat bastards and the Bush crime family. Say it again, Mike, for me. Those rat bastards and the Bush crime family. Can't repeat it too often. Thanks. Thank you, Anonymous. Or HH. I'll do that. HH. We are having, in about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Dave Smith with Politiscoop, politiscoop.com. He's the one who conducted an interview with and wrote about Matthew Schauenberg, who is propped against a pillar inside the Capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin, with a sign alerting passersby that he is conducting a hunger strike for democracy. Matt is from the east side of Madison in the Hawthorne neighborhood. He's conducting a hunger strike in opposition to Scott Walker's budget bill and in solidarity with Wisconsin State Union employees. He's a former union member. He worked as a steel climber and rigger for the IATSE division of the Teamsters. He's going on a hunger strike. He's going to continue it, he says, until Governor Walker decides to change his mind on collective bargaining. There's a second demand that Schauenberg is making, and that is for the governor to have a dialogue with independents and Democrats regarding the budget. Matt said he's prepared to deal with whatever he has to during his hunger strike, up to and including death for the cause of democracy. Now, Dave Smith at Politiscoop.com, who conducted an interview with him, and we had tried to get on the air last night, but just it was miscommunications. He's going to join us here in about 20 minutes. And regarding hunger strikers, Kay writes, Mike, your coverage of the Wisconsin hunger striker Matt Schauenberg made me think of another group of hunger strikers, the American suffragettes, or suffragists. As I'm sure most truth seekers know, the National Women's Party activists peacefully picketed in front of the White House during World War I, which got them arrested and jailed for obstructing traffic. As a political prisoner, their leader, Alice Paul, went on a hunger strike. When the newspapers got wind of what was going on inside the workhouse outside of Washington, D.C., the New York Times and Washington Post put the story on the front page. As a result, the pressure on President Wilson became so intense that he finally came out in favor of the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote. In the film Iron-Jawed Angels, Alice Paul, who went on the hunger strike, played by Hilary Swank, tells the prison psychiatrist about the reasons for her hunger strike and explains why she has resorted to this tactic. Quote, the hunger strike was a tradition in old Ireland. Do you really want a stinking corpse on your doorstep? What will the neighbors say? End quote. When I heard about Mr. Schauenberg's protest, I immediately thought about that last statement, which illustrates that in order for a hunger strike to be effective, word must get out. Without the media reports about Alice Paul's actions 100 years ago, the matter of women's suffrage would not have become an urgent one for President Wilson. My, how times have changed. In 1917, the United States still had journalists who did their job. The story of Alice Paul's hunger strike made the front page of American newspapers, which was crucial not only for the success of the suffragist movement, but for Miss Paul's survival. In contrast, none of the major papers are covering Matthew Schauenberg's actions, and it took me quite a while to find news about him on the Internet. How tragic to think that the hunger strike, the technique so effectively used in the past by activists like Alice Paul, Gandhi, Mitch Snyder, and others, no longer seems to carry any weight in this country, thanks to a media that has been completely co-opted by the corporations and their right-wing foot soldiers. Kay Petrini, we'll be right back.
Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Now, what I was talking about a minute ago about how mainstream media doesn't cover this kind of stuff, whether it is the arrests that occurred in the Michigan state capitol or the young man in the Capitol building, Matthew Schauenberg, who is on a hunger strike, don't need them. Did the Egyptians have mainstream media? No. As Reg at TVNewsLies.org writes, I posted a link to the Politiscope interview on Twitter and Facebook with a plea to spread the word. If every one of your listeners did that, so many more people would learn about this. And that is so true. You know, I've spent the last 15 years whining, like a lot of people have, about how one-sided and corporate-controlled mainstream media is. Okay, so why keep talking about it? It's a given. We all know that. We all know. For example, Saturday the 19th, there was essentially no mainstream media coverage of the event in Washington, D.C., and the arrests that occurred at the White House. They did show up the next day down in Quantico. A couple of them did, because they knew that the potential for chaos and violence at Quantico was much greater than what happened at the White House. So these blood-sucking bastards will go, especially television cameras, they will go where they think there's going to be gore and blood and heads broken open. But you put a million people in the street, don't know what you're talking about. What? A million people? What? You have thousands show up in Michigan and people get arrested. What? What, something happened? So, to hell with mainstream media. You make your own media. You are media, right? Remember I had Russell Baker on from whowhatwhy.com? When was it, a couple of weeks ago? Picked up something that he wrote at his website today. Do we have time to do this? I don't know. Let me see. I think we may have to wait until we come back after the break. Yeah, but you're going to like this. Oh, and the other day, well, what's the date today, Kathy? I lost track. Is this the 24th? No. What's today? 28th? 9th? 29th? MediaMatters.org had this posted about 4 or 5 days ago. The Rupert Murdoch terrorist organization and America-hating entertainment label, one of their employees, Oliver North, you remember him, the colonel, the disgraced colonel, the lying son of a bitch, the coward, the madman, the psychopath regarding Iran-Contra, the one who had no problem trading weapons, tow missiles to our sworn enemies, you know, him. He took to the airwaves on Rupert Murdoch's terrorist broadcast network to complain that Barack Obama didn't seek congressional authorization before intervening in Libya. Now, regardless of what you think of that intervention, just listen. North said, quote, quite frankly, it's unparalleled in my entire experience in the military going all the way back to the 1960s. Every president has gone to the Congress to get a resolution to support whatever it is he wanted to do. And Obama doesn't ask the Congress because he doesn't know what he wants to do. End quote. Now, you might question, if you took this clown bastard seriously, Oliver North's mental stability. Because back when he was a Marine colonel serving Reagan's White House, he helped run a secret, secret and illegal, after Congress said no, the Boland Amendment, a secret and illegal operation to sell weapons to Iran while using the proceeds to support the CIA-created Contra organization to overthrow Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. Beyond simply not authorizing the scheme, Congress had explicitly prohibited it. Oh, God. We got a break here, don't we? All right. I'll tell you what. We'll revisit this when we come back after we talk with Dave Smith of Politiscoop.com, because I do definitely want to get my 37 listeners clued in to Matthew Schoenberg's hunger strike at the Capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin. If my 37 listeners would each send to five people, and those five would each send to 10 people, and those 10 would each send to 15, well, you see, word would get out very quickly. And then at that point, corporate media would have to give it a little bit of attention, which would have the net effect of putting a little bit of pressure on this little Nazi son of a bitch that now thinks he runs Wisconsin. We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. People across the country will gather on April 4th for a day of action in support of workers. You can learn more about the events in your community by going to aprildayofaction.com. Please do that. Please check it out. You don't have to travel halfway across the country. You just have to check the website, aprildayofaction.com. And this hour is sponsored by Anonymous. I'll call him H. I'll call him Triple H. There you go. He writes, if only I had more dough with which to sponsor your program as well. Worth it to hear you call out the rat bastards in the Bush crime family. Say it again, Mike, for me, those rat bastards in the Bush crime family. Can't repeat it too often. Thanks. Thank you, Triple H. Anonymous. Dave Smith is a citizen journalist for Politiscoop.com. P-O-L-I-T-I-S-C-O-O-P. Politiscoop.com. His article, his interview with Matthew Schoenberg is what was sent to me by the editor of Politiscoop, and that's what woke me up to the story. He joins us now from Green Bay. Is that right, Dave?
That's correct, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. What I have here, and I don't know who wrote this. This was at your website. It's from about a week ago. Well, a little bit more. It's from the eighth day of Matt's hunger strike, which is back on March 12th. And it gives a little bit of background of Matthew Schauenberg, and I hope I'm saying his name right. It's Schauenberg?
That's how I believe it to be said.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen his video. That's what it sounds like.
Right. Hunger strike in opposition to Walker's budget, and the fact that he is saying that he is prepared to take this to its ultimate conclusion, which is starving to death. Is that your impression from... you conducted the interview, right?
I did.
Okay. Is that the impression that you got from him?
Oh, absolutely. He's dedicated to this cause. He understands people are trying to talk him out of it, but this is a cause that he's already has in his mind that he's willing to die for.
Now, he was a former union worker, a steel. I believe he worked on building big buildings. Right? Is that what he did? Go ahead.
He was a steel climber.
That's the kind of job that takes an awful lot of courage, I would think.
Oh, absolutely.
Or else no depth perception, no fear of heights. What is it? Do you think that made this young guy make this kind of a decision? Because the argument can be made that setting oneself on fire or fasting until death or any sort of extreme action like that just removes a warrior from the scene. So I'm just curious. I've never talked to anyone who was involved in something that in protests that they stated they were willing to take to the conclusion of their own death.
Right. It's his story is what caught my eye. It was brought to my attention, and I was looking around on the internet, and I just didn't see anything. And I was like, wow, this guy. I mean, the courage, and he obviously wasn't doing it for fame or fortune. And he sits in the rotunda each day, and the lawmakers walk by him each day, and they have to look at him, and he knows that. And he's not afraid, you know, you use the term warrior, he is a warrior. He looks them in the eye every day. He says, I haven't eaten for 25 days, but I'm here, and I'm still here.
It's also my understanding that not only have Republican members of the Wisconsin legislature ignored him, but with the exception, I think, of one Democrat, they've ignored him, too. Is that true?
Yeah, they all know he's there, and I don't know if they're scared to talk to him or they're worried somebody's going to take a picture, or I'm not sure what they're, you know, a lot of the Republicans, you know, said no comment, and even had one of them, the Hopper office, the staff, decided they thought it was kind of funny.
Who did?
Somebody at the Hopper staff.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
I don't know if he was reading jokes on his computer as he was talking to me or...
Yeah. I also find it strange that no local television station has seen fit to at least take one of their blow-dried, slim and trim young reporter gals out. No offense to women. I don't want to come across as a sexist here, but so many television stations will hire young men and young women who are very cute and very attractive, and you just want to eat them up. But as far as journalism, they don't know their ass from their elbows. But I'm surprised they haven't sent one of these cutesy poo boys or girls out to interview a man who said he is going to stay on this hunger strike until he dies. I don't
right.
get that.
I don't either. I've personally, not only have I called these senators, but I've called Channel 5, and I'll call them out. You know, I'll put them on my website, too. I've done it before. That Channel 5, I called them, Ed Walters at Channel 5, I said, look, this guy is already, I think it was like day 18. Mm-hmm. I said, he's willing to die for this cause. I said, have you guys, you know, do you know about it? And if not, now you do, you know? And he told me they had a sister station down there in Madison. So they wouldn't have had to gone, you know, mm-hmm. very far to, you know, go talk to him. They could have, you know, sent the feed all over the place, but they, you know, didn't even touch the story. But then we had a girl here at Politiscope, Kelly. She drove an hour and a half to go talk to this man,
mm-hmm.
you know. But unfortunately, he wasn't there that day. But, you know.
Now, when you say he's not there that day, he's not there every day?
No, he's there every day. That day, I forget why I remember what he said. He had something going on or something that he had to take care of. But I'm not sure why he wasn't there. But every you know, he blogs too, and you can tell when he's there.
Do you know his, does he have a web address? Does he have a blog site with a web address where people can get in touch with him?
I believe you can leave comments on his blog. Let me look here. Yeah, you can add comments to his blog. His blog is hungryguymadison.blogspot.com.
Hungryguymadison.blogspot.com.
Yep.
And people can leave a message there, or is it a live blog? Can people chat with him, or is it just leave a message and of support, or do you not know?
You can leave comments. It doesn't look mm-hmm. to be a live blog, but mm-hmm. Matt does, right there on his blog, he has his Facebook page, so, you know, and he's been adding a lot of people mm-hmm. that, you know, have come across his blog. So,
do you have any idea how many people, as a result of Politiscoop and your efforts and information getting out, how many people have been keyed into what this man is doing? Do you have any idea how effective the journalism here has been for this for Matthew?
For Matt, at first it was kind of slow, and then as the team here at Politiscoop, you know, got together, we're like, you know, we just started emailing everybody we could find, you know, trying to get somebody to listen to us, and we really appreciate you, you know, taking that story. It is just is great, because nobody else will.
Well, yeah. That's just astonishing to me, Dave. I mean, aside from the fact that this is one person who is not just talking the talk, but seriously walking the walk, the drama. And I use that word advisedly because I don't want to misunderstood. The drama of one man going up against this massively, almost seemingly impenetrable wall around Scott Walker, put there by the Koch family or whoever. The drama of one man, but that's all it usually takes sometimes. It's just one person, one man or one woman. Right before we had you on, we were talking about the one of the women who did a hunger strike in front of the White House during the Woodrow Wilson administration in support of women's suffrage, the right of women to vote, and how she was ignored until the New York Times and the Washington Post picked up the story. And that put so much pressure on Woodrow Wilson that he wound up coming out in favor of a woman's right to vote, the constitutional amendment necessary to make that happen. So Matthew's efforts, I think, clearly show that one person can have an effect. You know, the was he a flower seller or whatever he was in Tunisia, who set himself on fire and burned to death a couple of months ago, that started the revolt in Tunisia that spread to Egypt, that has spread across North Africa and the entire Middle East. It's that sort of thing sometimes that you never know where the what event is going to kickstart people and make them say, this is enough, I've had enough, it's time to get back to or get to some sort of democratic process. Do you think Matthew has a chance of doing that?
I do. I really do. I know that he's absolutely determined, and he's not, you know, he talks to people, and as he said in his interview, you know, the police officers there are coming up and checking on him, and some medical people within the building there are checking on him.
Good.
So, he's very, I just can say that I hope that he comes out victorious, but it's a, you know, it's one of those, it's a tragedy, and mm-hmm. it's like somebody going off to war, I guess. So.
I hear you. Well, Dave, you know, the country thanks journalists like you. Thank you for doing it, and please stay in touch with me about this, okay?
Absolutely, Mike. Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Dave Smith, citizen journalist with Politiscoop.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I got to tell you one thing. If you expect the freedom that you say is yours, prove that you deserve it. Help us to preserve it. Or being free will.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Triple H Anonymous, who laments the fact that he doesn't have quite enough dough with which to sponsor this program. Well, listen, you did fine, Triple H. He says, however, it's worth it to hear you call out the rat bastards in the Bush crime family. Say it again, Mike, for me. Those rat bastards in the Bush crime family. Can't repeat it too often. Thanks. Thank you, Triple H Anonymous. We appreciate it very, very much. Check out the blog site. I just went to his blog site, and it's, I don't know, interesting reading. Would that be the way to put it? It's intense. HungryGuyMadison.blogspot.com. Show him some support, okay? I've got to finish this thing about Oliver North, who came out of his crawl space the other night and complained that Barack Obama didn't seek congressional authorization before intervening in Libya, which in the strictest sense, he did not. But then North puts a noose around his own neck, and he says, quite frankly, it's unparalleled in my entire experience in the military, going all the way back to the 1960s. Every president has gone to Congress to get a resolution to support whatever it is he wanted to do, and Obama doesn't ask the Congress because he doesn't know what he wants to do, blah, 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 blah. Oliver North was a convicted felon. His conviction was overturned because testimony that had been sanitized, or whatever the hell the word is, that he gave before Congress was used to convict him, and that's a no-no. If you say it before Congress, you can't use it in a criminal court, so no, he may be guilty, but he's not going to serve any time. Anyway, it was Oliver North who, while serving as a Marine colonel in Reagan's White House, helped run a secret and illegal operation to sell weapons to Iran, tow missiles. And use the proceeds to support a CIA-created group of terrorists in Nicaragua that were trying to overthrow the duly elected government of Daniel Ortega, who was a socialist. Now, beyond simply not authorizing this filthy scheme, the U.S. Congress had explicitly prohibited it in what was referred to at the time as the Boland Amendment. Here's how independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, a Republican, described the Reagan administration's violations of U.S. law and efforts to deceive Congress in the Iran-Contra scandal. The Iran-Contra scandal concerned two secret Reagan administration policies whose operations were coordinated by National Security Council staff. The Iran operation involved efforts in 1985 and 86 to obtain the release of Americans held hostage in the Middle East through the sale of U.S. weapons to Iran, despite an embargo on such sales. The Contra operation from 1983 through most of 1986 involved the secret government support of Contra military and paramilitary activities in Nicaragua, despite congressional prohibition of the support. The Iran and the Contra operations were merged when funds generated from the sale of weapons to Iran were diverted to support the Contra effort in Nicaragua. Although this so-called diversion may be the most dramatic aspect of Iran-Contra, it is important to emphasize that both the Iran and the Contra operations separately violated U.S. law. The ignorance of the diversion asserted by President Reagan and his cabinet officers on the National Security Council in no way absolves them of responsibility for the underlying Iran and Contra operations, and so on. Oliver North was the linchpin in that operation. He was one of the ass-kissing, apple-polishing, up-and-coming colonels in the military. And he was also a criminal, an absolute criminal. When this whole thing started to unravel with people like John Poindexter, does that name mean anything to you? Elliot Abrams, that name mean anything to you? Oliver North? When it started to unwind, North returned to his office in the early evening of November 21st, 1986, and started shredding stacks of memoranda and messages with his secretary. What was her name? Fawn Hall. And destroying evidence. Ed Meese, who at the time was, I think he was still Attorney General. He may have graduated to be Reagan's senior advisor, but I think he was Attorney General. He oversaw the destruction of documents that led right to Reagan. Even if Ronald Reagan was unaware, because as Ron Jr. says, at the time, he was starting to suffer the effects of Alzheimer's, maybe. But even if he didn't understand, Ronald Reagan was used by these people. But Oliver North, for this cowardly son of a bitch, this disgrace to the United States Marine Corps, this man who took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and then just unzipped his fly and urinated all over that document in order to satisfy his right-wing fascist inclinations. This thug, this Sean Hannity-loving punk, Oliver North, has the absolute temerity to suggest that it's unparalleled in his entire experience in the military, going all the way back to the 60s, where a president has not gone to Congress to get a resolution to support this kind of action. You lying dog. You lying piece of human waste. Oliver North. Oliver North, a disgrace to the Marine Corps and a thug. You think I'm a little pissed off about this guy? I have had nothing but contempt for this creep for the past 30 years. Stick around. We have much more fun and frivolity coming up. I'm Mike Malloy. Sponsored by Guy. I guess I should leave off the last names. Guy, last name, Junior. And he writes, Mike, I've followed you since WLS. Oh, my God. This is for my kids, Guy the Third and Lona, wishing them the kind of America to grow up in that I had. Love, Dad. Well, that's sweet. You know, that's same wish I have for Molly. Of course, it's not going to happen. Anyway, thanks, Guy. Guy, his last name, Junior. Mike, I've followed you since WLS. This is for my kids, Guy the Third and Lona. Wishing them the kind of America to grow up in that I had. Love, Dad. Oliver North. Michael and Roswell writes, Oliver North got his conviction overturned because Lawrence Silberman and David Sentell, two of the most extreme right-wingers in the federal judiciary, were on the three-man appeals court that heard his appeal, not because Lawrence Walsh had trod into his immunized testimony before Congress. Walsh was too smart for that. That was just the excuse given by those two justices. That North is pontificating on the subject of constitutionality is laughable. He's an outright fascist. Yeah, and lest we forget, Oliver North apparently has Ronald Reagan's invasion of Grenada after Ronald Reagan sent 241 unarmed Marines to their death at the barracks in Beirut, Lebanon. in 1983. It was Reagan's idea to, during the Lebanese Civil War, one of many, to stick all these Marines unarmed, unauthorized to use their weapons. You can make your own decision about that. But in other words, taking 200, well, it was more than that. There was probably a regiment of Marines that were there, but 241 were blown to pieces in the Marine barracks bombing. I think it was a truck bomb. And it was the next day or the day after that that Reagan invaded Grenada, or ordered the invasion of Grenada. There was no congressional approval. There was none of this. So Oliver North, God, I just don't want to get too deep into Oliver North, because of all the people on earth who infuriate me, I think he's right at the top of the list, because he has always wrapped himself in the flag and tried to come across like he's some kind of a military hero. When he was a military coward, he was in combat, but he was a psychopath. And I have a problem with people who swear an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and then do everything to undermine that Constitution, whether it is Dick Cheney or George Bush or Oliver North. So I'll just leave it go, Mike. That was ancient history. Nobody cares. Two priests, a nun, and two women in their 60s who cut through fences at Naval Base Kitsap, Bangor, in the state of Washington to protest submarine nuclear weapons were sentenced yesterday to prison terms ranging from 2 to 15 months. U.S. District Judge sentenced Jesuit priest Stephen Kelly, 62, of Oakland, California, retired teacher Susan Crane, 67, of Baltimore, both to 15 months in prison. Jesuit priest Bill Bischel, 82, of Tacoma, sentenced to 3 months in prison and 6 months of home monitoring. Sister Ann Montgomery, 84, of Redwood City, California, 2 months in prison, 4 months of home monitoring. And social worker Lynn Greenwald, 61, of Tacoma, 6 months in prison and 60 hours of community service. 62, 67, 61, 82, and 84. All five defendants also were given 1 year of supervised release. They were ordered into custody Monday. The judge praised the five defendants for their humanitarian work, but said he was bound by the law to send a message that legal means must be used to bring about change. How much of that do you want to attack? How much of that statement do you... Legal means. Mr. Judge, what legal means is there to stop nuclear-armed submarines? A federal jury, and this is the part, jury nullification is a very real process. And if ever there was a time it should have been used, it was in this case. But a federal jury convicted these five anti-war demonstrators of conspiracy, trespass, destruction of government property. They had faced up to 10 years in prison, and the prosecutors recommended sentences ranging between 6 months and 36 months. Court documents say these five people cut through the fences on November 2, 2009 to reach an area where nuclear warheads are stored in bunkers. They put up banners, sprinkled blood, their own, on the ground, scattered sunflower seeds, and prayed until they were arrested. The Bangor base, about 20 miles west of Seattle on Hood Canal, is home to 10 Ohio-class submarines, 8 armed with Trident ballistic missiles and 2 with conventional weapons. About 250 demonstrators gathered outside the federal courthouse yesterday before the sentencing. Some demonstrators carried signs saying, "Blessed are the peacemakers." Stephen Kelly, 62, the retired Jesuit priest, I guess he's not retired, told Seattle radio station KOMO that he was prepared to go to prison. He said, quote, "I think it's really worth it. I have the solace of my conscience, as I think this is just one little step against nuclear weapons, and someday we'll be free. Maybe not in my lifetime, but I have hope," end quote. You see, now this, you know, this kind of story takes me to, you know, my horrific issue with religion. I maintain that these five people, two priests, a nun, and two women in their 60s, the three religious people, would have done this anyway. I don't believe that their religious training has that much to do with the decision to put themselves on the line against nuclear weapons. I just don't. Why? Because nowhere in the Bible does it talk about making a stand against nuclear weapons. Okay, how's that grab you? As a matter of fact, next hour, when I was a kid growing up, we used to go to prayer meeting on Wednesday night, and all of a sudden, it's turning out that on Tuesday nights on this program, for some reason, Kathy and I were noticing this, seems to be the night that I have church on this program and get all funky and crazy and sweaty about organized religion because I despise it so much. But here's an example, two priests and none and two women in their 60s. The one priest is 82. One of the sisters was 84. Now, you know, people will send me emails like stories about this when I go off about religion and say, how do you explain this? Well, I explain it simply by saying that religion does not necessarily make you moral or ethical. And as a matter of fact, some of the most moral, ethical people that I've ever met have been people who have nothing whatsoever to do with religion and despise it. So the fact that these five people put themselves on the line and decided to become prisoners of conscience, I have great respect for. Great respect. I mean, it's 82, 84, 61, 62, and 67 are their ages. I mean, what does that have to do with religion? To me, nothing. Absolutely nothing. And has everything to do with the ethical framework within which these people live their lives. We'll be back. Listen up. People across the country will gather on April 4th for a day of action in support of workers. You can learn more about events in your community at aprildayofaction.com. aprildayofaction.com. Check it out, okay? Now, Russell Baker was on this program a couple of weeks ago. He is the editor-in-chief, I guess, of whowhatwhy.com. And if you haven't been to whowhatwhy.com, you're missing a website that is just chock-a-block with stuff that you should know about. whowhatwhy.com. Get this. Russ Baker writes following. Here's a quiz. Embattled Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, good or bad? How about GE chairman and CEO Jeffrey Immelt, good or bad? Okay, here are your answers straight from the top. That would be the president. Gaddafi, way bad. Immelt, good guy, business civic leader, should be a key advisor to the president. On Gaddafi, we already knew he was a bad guy, but now we find out what he's been up to that really distresses business leaders. The very same business leaders who profoundly influence the American political process and the foreign policy decisions this country makes. According to a report in the New York Times, are you ready? You knew this was going to come. Here it is. In 2009, top aides to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi called together 15 executives from global energy companies operating in Libya's oil fields and issued an extraordinary demand. Shell out the money for his country's $1.5 billion bill for its role in the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 and other terrorist attacks. If the companies did not comply, the Libyan officials warned, there would be, quote, serious consequences, end quote, for their oil leases, according to a State Department summary of the meeting. The episode and others like it, the officials said, reflect a Libyan culture rife with corruption, kickbacks, strong-arm tactics, and political patronage since the United States reopened trade with Colonel Gaddafi's government in 2004. Who was president then? Oh, that's right. As American and international oil companies, telecommunications firms, and contractors moved into the Libyan market, they discovered that Colonel Gaddafi or his loyalists often sought to extract millions of dollars in signing bonuses and consultancy contracts, or insisted that his sons get a piece of the action through shotgun partnerships. End of quote from the Times. Okay. Baker asks, who wants to pay such bribes? Solution? Get rid of him! Now let's turn to Jeffrey Immelt. First, you need to know that he's the darling of the political and media establishment. The president is extremely high on him. President Obama has chosen Immelt for a super crucial position for him and his reelection fundraising apparatus as the White House's business community liaison. Ooh, that's shorthand for the kind of people who intercede with big companies that might or might not help fund the campaign, a bit like those Muammar Gaddafi signing bonuses cited a moment ago. Even more importantly, Obama has named him chairman of the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness. Keep this in mind when you consider the following. How is Immelt going to, or how is Immelt helping this country out? For one thing, he is the king of job exporters, a pillar of the Indian economy. But that's not all. As I told you the other night, Immelt's company pays no U.S. taxes. That's right, no taxes. According to the Times again, General Electric, the nation's largest corporation, had a very good year in 2010. The company reported worldwide profits of $14.2 billion and said $5.1 billion of the total came from its operations in the United States. Its American tax bill, zero. In fact, GE claimed a tax benefit of $3.2 billion. This may be hard to fathom for the millions of American business owners and households now preparing their own returns, but low taxes are nothing new for GE. The company has been cutting the percentage of its American profits paid to the IRS for years, resulting in a far lower rate than most multinational companies pay when they do pay. Its extraordinary success, GE's, is based on an aggressive strategy that mixes fierce lobbying for tax breaks and innovating accounting that enables it to concentrate its profits offshore. GE's giant tax department, led by a bow-tied former Treasury official named John Samuels, is often referred to as the world's best tax law firm. Indeed, the company's slogan, Imagination at Work, that's GE's slogan, fits this department well. The team includes former officials not just from Treasury, but also from the IRS and virtually all the tax writing committees in Congress. Well, so who is the bigger threat to the solvency of the United States? Muammar Gaddafi or Jeffrey Immelt? And which one works for the President of the United States?
He went to fight wars for his country and his king. his honor and his glory, the people would sing.
Because without dissent, it's not America. Here's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, we were talking about Jeffrey Immelt, the new very close personal advisor to Barack Obama, and the comparison between Muammar Gaddafi and Jeffrey Immelt, which I think is a great comparison. Russ Baker at whowhatwhy.com put this together today. We had Russ Baker on the program a few weeks ago, right around the time. That wasn't the launch of that website, but it was just, hadn't been out there that long, has it? I don't think so. If you haven't gone to whowhatwhy.com, you're missing an excellent source. And again, this hour is sponsored by Guy, last name, Junior. I'm just getting paranoid about giving people's last names. I don't know. And he has a message. Mike, I followed you since WLS. This is for my kids, Guy the Third and Lona, wishing them the kind of America to grow up in that I had. Love, Dad. I hear you on that. And I, you know, you can understand what he means by that. He's talking about his own personal experience, I'm sure. Growing, I don't know how old Guy is, but there was a time in this country where it wasn't very pleasant for a lot of people. But you understand what he's saying. There was an innocence back then for a lot of folks. I being one, that is gone. My daughter won't have that. My 32-year-old son didn't have that. Anyway, back. General Electric made worldwide profits in 2010 of $14 plus billion. $5.1 billion of the total came from its operations in the U.S. It paid nothing in taxes, absolutely nothing. So Barack Obama decided to hire this guy to put him in a super crucial position, is what Russ Baker calls it. For him, Obama, and his reelection fundraising apparatus, as the White House's new business community liaison. And as Russ Baker points out, that's shorthand for the kind of people who intercede with big companies that might or might not help fund the campaign, a bit like those Gaddafi signing bonuses. The part that really got to me here about what Russ put together, what Russ wrote and his sources, is the fact that 2 years ago, Muammar Gaddafi got these 15 executives together and decided to blackmail them to the tune of $1.5 billion if they wanted to continue operating in Libya's oil fields. And the companies, of course, one can guess, although it doesn't say it here, they complied. American companies always get involved in graft and corruption overseas, especially where it concerns natural resources like oil. They don't give a damn. Well, you know what? You think ExxonMobil cares if they hand somebody, $50 million? That's chump change. That's lunch money. That's what Rush Limbaugh makes every year. That's nothing. It's a flick off a fly's ass. It doesn't mean a thing. When you have a company like ExxonMobil that makes in a quarter what GE makes in a year, you think $50 million means anything? Means nothing. So, they hire Obama hires Jeffrey Immelt. And as Russ Baker writes, Immelt's got the situation wired from top to bottom. All his options hedged. That's why he's a good guy, unlike Gaddafi, whose brutality was never enough of a problem until he began shaking down American oil companies. You ever notice that? How many times have you heard Gaddafi has been a dictating son of a bitch for 41 years? Why now? What? What's the deal here? Oh, my goodness. All of a sudden, Gaddafi starts to get crazier. And you know how you measure one of our little dictator boys' craziness? It's when he starts leaning too hard on the U.S. business community, especially the oil section. Once that happens, goodbye, little dictator. Goodbye! Goodbye! See ya! Goodbye! Now, as Russell Baker writes, why is Jeffrey Immelt Obama's guy? Good question. He was a political donor to George W. Bush. And in July 2004, during Bush's reelection campaign, Immelt was quoted by the Bush campaign saying, quote, "This is the best economy we've seen in years," end quote. Now, of course, the "we" he's referring to was predatory capitalism, of which Jeffrey Immelt is a leading leader. Oh, my God. Then he started getting the group hug from the Democrats and the liberal media. Pretty soon, the hagiographies were pouring in. In 2005, Bill Clinton rolled out his Clinton Global Initiative with Immelt as one of the attending big names. In February 2006, while touting his book, Take It Back, Our Country, Our Party, Our Future, on Meet the Press, former Clinton operative Paul Begala described Jeffrey Immelt as, quote, "the greatest guy, that is to say, environmentally correct and profit-making." Environmentally correct. Oh, my God. Paul Begala has just, I don't know, he's going to hurt himself if he continues to do that to himself. You know what I'm saying with that? Of course you do. So, Jeffrey Immelt was interviewed by Charlie Rose. Immelt, we got to compete. We got to be smart. We got to use our entrepreneurial ability. We've got to get more kids studying engineering. You know, while Immelt does his part to devastate the American job market. But anyway, Charlie Rose says, you know, all these candidates, are they talking about it? Are they aware of it? Is it part of their conscience? Are they, as they think about leading this country? This was back in 2007. Immelt, I think in varying degrees it is. You know, I think Senator Clinton understands it. I've talked to her. I think Governor Romney clearly gets it. I think Rudy has always gotten it. I think he's been able to do that. But Charlie Rose, Senator Obama get it? Immelt, I think they all do. Charlie Rose, they get the idea that the U.S. has to be competitive around the world? Not only competitive, though, in terms of Immelt, hard work. Charlie Rose, hard work, yes. And also competitive. Where do you think we have to be competitive in terms of values and what we stand for and who we are? Does that matter? Jeffrey Immelt. I think as an American, it clearly matters, right? I mean, values are part of the bedrock of a successful country. I think values count, Charlie. I don't want to pass judgment on anybody here tonight, but values are important for this country. Values are important. So, as Russell Baker says, there you have it. Values count. And politicians can count, too. Somehow, guys like Jeffrey Immelt count for more than millions of us. Strange, strange math in this country. Woo! Go Russell Baker. That's a great comparison. Jeffrey Immelt and Muammar Gaddafi. Great comparison. Colonel Oliver North and any criminal bastard who has ever tried to undermine and destroy this country, like Oliver North's boss, well, his, one of his current bosses, the terrorist, Rupert Murdoch. Well, third hour tonight, we're going to do church. So if you don't want to hear religion bashing, don't just go away. Just go away, okay? I don't mean to say that nasty. I'm just saying, you know, you won't like it. Oh, in his latest trip to New Hampshire, Republican Rick Santorum says the Social Security system would be in much better shape if there were fewer abortions. The former Pennsylvania senator and possible presidential candidate was asked about Social Security during an interview on a radio station in New Hampshire this morning. And Rick Santorum, this crazy bastard, says the system has design flaws, Social Security, but the reason it's in big trouble is that there aren't enough workers to support retirees. Okay, you're way ahead of me. He blamed that on what he called the nation's abortion culture. Did you know that? We have an abortion culture here. Rick Santorum says that culture, coupled with policies that do not support families, deny America what it needs, more people. Son of a bitch, how many things do you want to scream about in that little tirade, huh? Abortion culture, don't get me started on that. He said, coupled with policies that do not support families, Rick, you thuggish, phony son of a bitch and your cohorts are the ones who put those policies in place. And to say that the reason there's big trouble with Social Security, there aren't enough workers to support retirees, has nothing to do with abortion, you half-witted moron. It has to do with the fact that there are no jobs! And, Rick, the once somebody reaches $104,000 or whatever it is in income, they don't have to pay any more on a graduated scale FICA tax. Son of a bitch. Boy, I hate these people, these single-minded freaks like Rick Santorum. America's abortion culture. Boy, I had no idea. I just didn't realize that I lived in an abortion culture. What is that, Rick, huh? This is the guy that when his wife...
That's located, Mike, right next door to the gay agenda.
Oh, right next to the... Okay. This is the... That's probably... You're probably right. This is the guy who, when his wife miscarries or gives still birth or whatever the hell it was, they put the thing in a jar of formaldehyde and bring it home and then take it out and dry it off and hand it to his living children to play with. I mean, what kind of goddamn freaks do we have in this country? Pardon my language, but if it offends you, think about Rick Santorum. Has been sponsored by Guy, and his last name, Junior. That's not his last name, it's Guy, his last name, then Junior. This message, Mike, I've followed you since WLS. This is for my kids, Guy the Third and Lona, wishing them the kind of America to grow up in that I had. Love, Dad. Thanks, Guy. I appreciate the sentiment and the sponsorship. Thank you. Regarding fasting... Hunger strike, I should say. From Cat Mary in Memphis. In old Ireland, under Brehonic law, I know I'm mispronouncing that, but that's the way it's spelled. Under Brehonic law, hunger strikes were used when all other legal means had failed. In other words, when there was no legislative machinery to enforce justice. The injured person would go to the house of the person who had wronged him and go without food until he starved or until he received justice. Usually, this was at the house of the local king because hunger strikes were only done under deadly serious conditions, such as the ones now in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the U.S. where neo-fascists are in office. The king was compelled by public custom and belief to not let anyone die on his doorstep. Usually, after a few days, and certainly not as long as Matt Schellenberg is gone. After a few days, the king would go out, bring food to the plaintiff, and talk things over, which generally resulted in a good conclusion. If the king didn't yield, but let the person starve to death, he lost public approval and was considered cursed. The king didn't last very long after that because the ancient Irish took curses very seriously. So should Scott Walker. Another interesting thing about Brehonic law is that it was based on compensation, not on vengeance. So the old Irish generally didn't kill criminals, but instead made them pay a blood price and a status price to the victim or the victim's family. If the criminal couldn't do that, he had to work for the family, or be sold for their benefit. Well, there you go. Cat Mary in Memphis. Ah. Newt Gingrich. This would be a good way to finish up this hour. Gingrich, you know, is working real hard to make inroads with the crazy evangelical Christian voters so that Newt can become president. So he's gone to a real demon from the 2008 campaign to help him do that. This past Sunday, yesterday, day before yesterday, Gingrich was the keynote speaker at Cornerstone Church, San Antonio megachurch, headed by the Pastor John Hagee. Pastor Hagee. How far did you go? Well, I went Pastor Hagee. McCain got an endorsement during the 08 campaign from Pastor Hagee, but later disavowed that support after several comments Hagee had made about the origins of Hurricane Katrina came to light. Among other things, Hagee told National Public Radio after Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans had suffered, quote, the judgment of God because of the level of sin. Oh, and he also referred to the Catholic Church as the great whore and a false cult system, none of which is necessarily untrue. But, you know, I mean, one religious person standing in the pulpit cursing another one is a little bit weird, especially since Newt Gingrich is now converted to Catholicism. The tipping point for McCain was Hagee's comment that Adolf Hitler had been fulfilling God's will by targeting Jews. Isn't religious fun? Isn't religion fun? And the big mouth, lard ass spokesman for religion, aren't they just a hoot, huh? Aren't they a hoot? Gingrich sees an opening because Mike Huckabee is starting to fade fast, and Gingrich is out there on the religious circuit with that demonic look of his. You ever notice how Gingrich looks like a snake? He looks exactly, look at his little beady eyes. He looks exactly like a snake that is about to spring at a gopher. He looks like a great big-ass rattlesnake about to spring at a gopher with those that mouth wide open. Gingrich, the rattlesnake. But he sees an opening. And that's why he's been going around on appearing on all the religious television networks, getting all contrite about his adultery and his failed marriages and cheating on his wife and banging interns when he is accusing Bill Clinton of banging. You'll pardon my language, but what the hell are you going to call it? When he's accusing Bill Clinton of banging interns, right? I mean, if you look in any dictionary on Earth, under the word hypocrite, you'll find a picture of Newt Gingrich. So, speaking at Cornerstone Church day before yesterday, Gingrich expressed worries about the nation losing its faith and becoming a, quote, secular atheist country, end quote. And, of course, that got him a standing ovation from the crazy people that go to Cornerstone Church, the ones that think Pastor Hagee is really Pastor Hagee. Gingrich said, the faith, the heart of our faith is that this is a temporary moment on a much larger journey and that we should spend this life preparing for a much larger life. He really wants to be president, doesn't he? If you live purely secularly and you believe there is no much larger life, then all of this is very foolish, end quote. Oh, Newt. Oh, my God. You know, one thing you can be sure of that Newt is full of himself. Newt, what about Pastor Hagee referring to your mother church now as a huge whore? Did that come up in your little speech there? All right, stick around. It is Tuesday night. That means it's church on my program, sort of. I've got something written by Cenk Younger. You know, Cenk the Young Turks, that he wrote 6 years ago. That I love, I've kept, and you're gonna love. Plus some other stuff about who's really in hell. Ooh, fun third hour coming. I'm Mike Malloy. Stick around. the Malloy Program, which is what you're about to hear, is sponsored by Patricia Kunkel. No message, just the sponsorship. Thank you, Patricia. It is deeply appreciated. And like I told you earlier tonight, I'm dealing with pollen again. The pollen here in Atlanta. The three worst cities in America for pollen are all in Georgia. No, they are, seriously. Savannah, Augusta, and Atlanta. Not necessarily in that order. But that's what all the coughing and hacking is about. It has nothing to do with cold, or I don't get colds anymore. It has everything to do with pollen. So I apologize yet again. You know, when I was a kid, when I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, my maternal grandparents, the immigrants from Italy, who assimilated by becoming Baptists, they figured that was the way to go. I don't think my grandfather was very religious anyway, but my grandmother was. She bought into all that hellfire and brimstone and crazy, crazy stuff that is Christianity. And I spent an awful lot of time with them when I was a kid growing up. So on Wednesday nights, it would be prayer meeting night. I think it still is. A lot of you folks who continue to torture yourselves with religious nonsense, you know that Wednesday night is prayer meeting night. And it's kind of like we've changed things in this program. Tuesday night is now anti-prayer meeting night. And we don't devote the entire program to it. I know a lot of you folks are just so tired of my anti-religious tirades. Well, if I really saw that there was a horrible sickness eating at human beings, I think I would talk about it. And that's the way I look at religion. So if you want to bow out this last hour, okay. Bye. See you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. Now, if you're still here, two little items. The second one is written by somebody that I think you know. You see him on television a lot. But this first one, have you heard about this guy? Rob Bell, who is described by the Associated Press as a prominent young evangelical pastor and critic of the traditional view of hell as a place of eternal torment for billions of damned souls. Yeah, this guy, Rob Bell, he has written a book called Love Wins. Love Wins. Oy, anytime I see, something written by a religious person that has the word love in it, you know, all the warning bells go off. But Rob Bell, he's the pastor in Grand Rapids, Michigan, of one of these mega churches, 10,000-member Mars Hill Bible Church in Grand Rapids. And he lays out the premise of his book that, you know, people don't go to hell. Well, I mean, that's the whole foundation of Christianity. It's not the risen Savior. It's not the crucified Lord. It's not the birth of the Redeemer. It is hell is waiting for you if you don't repent your filthy, dirty, rotten, stinking sins. And, of course, there's only one way to do that, and that's to be, and I've always been intrigued by this phrase, born again. You're going to be born again. Bell says he went to, before he wrote the book, he went to a Christian art show. Don't ask. I have no idea. He went to a Christian art show where one of the pieces featured a quote by Gandhi. And that was probably the one that said something to the effect of, I like your Christ. Gandhi was reported as saying, I like your Christ. I have some doubts about your Christians, right? But anyway, someone had attached a little note to it saying, reality check, he's in hell. And Bell says he stood there and he said, Gandhi's in hell? He is? And someone knows this for sure? So anyway, in the book, Reverend Bell criticizes the belief that a select number of Christians will spend eternity in the bliss of heaven while everyone else is tormented forever in hell. And he says in his book, quote, this is misguided and toxic and ultimately subverts the contagious spread of Jesus' message of love, peace, forgiveness, and joy that our world desperately needs to hear. He says, now, for traditional Christians, though, and my grandmother would have been among them, Bell's book sounds a lot like the old theological position of universalism, heresy for real Christians, because universalism teaches that people, that everyone, regardless of religious belief, will ultimately be saved by God, and that, they argue, dangerously misleads people about the reality of the Christian faith. You know, to believe that there's a loving God someplace who goes, well, look at those little squirming things down on the little fleck of dust. My little experiment down there. Oh, aren't they cute? Well, as each one of them croaks, I'll just put them over here in my little heaven packet and everything will be fine. No, 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 no. Because if that were the case, who would buy into these three ridiculous, stupid, bloody religions, especially Christianity? Who would buy it if they didn't think that waiting for them at the end of their lives was some horrific torture chamber? Demons, bugs, spiders. Oh, my God. Look at any Bosch painting if you want an idea. Hieronymus Bosch, who either was a great satirical painter or had gone completely mad on his own religious fears and horrors and terrors. You know, the hell thing. And of course, the Reverend Bell, who wrote this book, comments on the near relish, just the absolute glee with which some Christians stress the torment of hell. I've noticed that. It's like, hey, I've been saved. I've been born again. But you miserable bastard, not you. No, no. And guess what? You're going to burn in hell forever. Wow. Really? And you know what? Children are taught this. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. We've had experiences with Molly where at age 6 and a half, she will comment on what some little children that she comes into contact with, what they say. Are you saved? And Molly just kind of looks at him like, you're going to burn in hell if you're not. I mean, that's some sick, degenerate stuff to put on a kid, right? To put on anybody, put on an adult. But anyway, this belief in hell, Reverend Bell writes, is one of the reasons that a lot of people just stay away from Christianity because it's too freaky. Now, having said that, I hate that expression. Having just told you about just a little bit here about the Reverend Rob Bell, the pastor and author of the new book, Love Wins. Since we come back from this break, I want to share with you something that was written 6 years ago by Cenk Unger. Is that how you pronounce his last name? Cenk Unger, one of the Young Turks. You see him on MSNBC now. He has his own online program. He's on MSNBC, and I want to share with you something that he wrote 6 years ago that I first read on the program 6 years ago because I thought it was just brilliant. And it may not be brilliant, but it is very powerful, so stick around.
Standing up to the flying monkey right. It's Mike Malloy.
Went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sewing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now, you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin.
Too bad, Charlie.
But I'll take your bet. You're going to
too bad Charlie Daniels is such a right-wing freak." But I love that. I love that record. Always have. Well, Rob Bell, prominent young evangelical pastor, has decided that hell is not a place for eternal torment for billions of souls. And for that, he is being, well, given a lot of hell. You know what I'm saying? All right. Now, that was the setup, the first part. Now, Cenk, one of the Young Turks, 6 years ago, wrote the following. "We live in a twisted world where right is wrong and wrong reigns supreme. It is a chilling fact that most of the world's leaders believe in nonsensical fairy tales about the nature of reality. They believe in gods that do not exist and religions that could not possibly be true. We are driven to war after war, violence on top of violence to appease madmen who believe in gory mythologies. These men are called Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Osama bin Laden is insane. He believes God whispered in the ear of Muhammad 1,400 years ago about how he should conquer Arabia. Muhammad was a pure charlatan, and a good one at that. He makes present religious frauds like Pat Robertson look like amateurs. He said God told him to have sex with as many of the women he met as possible. I'm sorry, I meant to say, quote, take them as wives, end quote. God told him to kill all the other tribes that stood in the way or that would not placate with him or placate him with assurances of loyalty or bribes. God told Muhammad conveniently that everyone should follow him and never question a word he said. He sold this bag of goods to the blithering idiots who lived in the Arabian Peninsula at the time. If that weren't shockingly stupid enough, over a billion people continued to believe the convenient lies that Muhammad told all that time ago to this very day. We live in a world full of insane people. Sanity is an island battered in an ocean of frothing delusion. The people who believe in science are the minority. The people who believe in bloody fairy tales are the overwhelming majority. George W. Bush is the most powerful man alive. He is a Class A imbecile. He is far less intelligent than the average Christian, but like most of the others, he believes Jesus died for his sins. That idea is so perverse and devoid of logic, it should shock the conscience. Instead, it gets him elected and earns him the reverence of a great percentage of America. America, the most advanced country in the world, run by a bunch of villagers who still believe Santa Claus is going to save them. There is no damn Easter Bunny. There is no Jesus waiting to return. Moses never even existed. They were all convenient lies from the men of those times to gain power. Their actions were rational. They wanted to deceive their brethren so that they could amass power. I get their motivation, but I cannot for the life of me understand our motivation. Thousands of years later, still following the con men of yesteryear into our gory, bloody, violent end. Jesus is said to have spoke on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, because Jesus was insane and the God he thought would rescue him did not exist. And he died on that cross like a fool. He fancied himself the Son of God and he could barely convince 12 men to follow him at a time when the world was full of superstition. Excellent marketing by some of his followers would later rescue his botched effort. How many people saw his miracles? One? 12? 80? Why didn't he show the whole world? Not because this is some giant pop quiz by God to test us, but because he did not perform any miracles. Even his apostles can't agree on what miracles he supposedly carried out or when he carried them out. Or whether he returned after death or he didn't. Whether he saw him in person or just a vision. rational human beings shouldn't believe this kind of nonsense. Yet most of the world does. If a man today killed his only son to show how much he loved other people, he would be considered a madman, locked in jail, and he would earn society's contempt. Yet we think this is some sort of noble act by our Father in heaven. There's more here. Cenk Unger, who wrote this, one of the Young Turks, who wrote this back in 2005. And just a little bit more here that I'll share with you when we come back. When I first read this, I thought, Cenk, really? Way to go. Cool, man. Welcome to the welcome to the little spotlight over here in the darkness that is religious insanity. More when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Discover.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games and daisy chains.
Arm yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, finishing up a piece that Cenk Unger, one of the Young Turks, I hope we're pronouncing his last name right, wrote 5 or 6 years ago about the madness of religion. He goes on, I know most of you don't actually read your religious texts, and when you do, you assiduously try to avoid the parts that make no sense whatsoever or hide underneath the comforting grasp of your religious leaders who have concocted a bunch of circular logic to shield you from the obvious folly of the written text. So I'm not calling you stupid if you haven't really read the material, and I know how powerful brainwashing is. We all received it when we were young, and it is exceedingly difficult to break its grasp. But people dance around the issue out of politeness because they don't want to call you what you are. Ignorant! There are a lot of people I love dearly and respect wholeheartedly who believe in religion. I hate to do this to them. But we have killed far too many people, wasted far too much time on this nonsense for us to keep going in this direction for fear of offense. Jesus was a lunatic. God is not coming to your rescue. He hasn't come to anyone's rescue in thousands of years, including Jesus. Muhammad was a power-hungry scam artist and ruthless conqueror. Moses and Abraham were figments of the imagination of some long-dead rabbi. He would probably laugh his ass off at all of you who still believe the fairy tales he made up thousands of years ago. He probably wouldn't even believe it if you told him. Did I mention Judaism? The chosen people? Come on, get off it. People walk around in clothes from 18th century Russia thinking they have been chosen by God when they all look like a bunch of jackasses. I'm tired of all the deaths because we did not want to give offense. Orthodox Jews are wrong, and ridiculous, as are the Orthodox and fundamentalists of all the religions. It says in the Bible that it is an abomination to wear clothes made of two different cloths or to eat shellfish. If you think God will hate you because you mixed wool and linen or because you ate some shrimp, you are insane. How long are we going to dance around the 800-pound gorilla in the room? The world is run by madmen. It's not just Bush and Bin Laden. It's the leader of all the countries in the Middle East, almost all of the Americans, and most of the rest of the world. Have I offended you with all this? That's too bad. Stop killing each other in the name of false and ridiculous gods, and I will stop ridiculing you. Trust me. Your offense is much worse than mine. Right now, as you read this, there are ignorant, hateful Muslims teaching other ignorant Muslims how to put on a suicide belt. There are Orthodox Jews telling other Jews how they must never leave their so-called Holy Land, no matter what the consequences are to other human beings. They assure their followers, remember, they are not the chosen ones. We are, they tell their followers. If we crush and oppress them, don't worry. God will excuse it and even desires it because he is on our side. And there are maniacal Christians who are praying for the end of time. We're hoping that most of the world's population is wiped off the face of the earth by their vengeful and murderous God, whom they believe is, ironically, a loving God. Unless, of course, you make the fatal mistake of not kissing his ass and appeasing him. In which case, he will slaughter you and condemn you to eternal torture.
Has your computer been slowing you down?
What kind of sick
Are you
people
having...
believe this? The kind who live next door to you. The kind who voted for George Bush. The kind who send their religious leaders to the White House to argue against even-handedness in the Middle East because it would prevent their sick prophecy. The kind who have undue influence over how we use the greatest and most lethal army ever built by man. If you don't want to be called ignorant or misinformed, then get informed. Learn the real nature of our universe and put aside old wives' tales about resurrected gods, omniscient prophets, and a guy who could split the Red Sea but couldn't find where he's going in the desert for 40 years. It's the year 2005. Let's start acting like it. Jenk Ugers? Jenk Ugers? One of the Young Turks wrote that 6 years ago. And every once in a while I come across it again and I read it and I think, not necessarily brilliant writing, no more than mine is, but certainly a cri de coeur asking for rationality in the face of this onslaught of religious insanity that is doing nothing here or anyplace else except just ripping the planet and the human species into a million pieces. All in the name of appeasing some crazed... Oh, well, you know. And then this poor guy in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Michigan. Who, the pastor of the Mars Hill Bible Church, 10,000 member Mars Hill Bible Church, who now comes out and says, well, I don't know, I just have a hard time believing that Gandhi's in hell. I don't think hell really exists. Uh-oh. Have I mentioned this hour is being sponsored by Patricia Kunkel? Thank you, Patricia. Her message? There isn't one. She just sponsored the hour. Thank you, Patricia. Did you do that when you were a kid? Were you? Did you have to go to prayer meeting? Whew. I remember listening to the fervent prayers in a room upstairs from the sanctuary. Yeah, a literal upper room, where on Wednesday nights after work, after supper, summertime. And, of course, this is before everybody, or very few people at the time, had air conditioning, especially not in Ohio, especially not in northern Ohio. But the summers would still get hotter than, well, hell. And to go there with my grandparents and sit on those straight-back chairs, you know, those wooden straight-back chairs, you know what I'm talking about, ladder backs, huh? Weren't those comfortable? And to have, when you walk into the room for the prayer meeting, whoever was conducting the prayer meeting, it might be the pastor, it might be assistant pastor, it might be just some person who felt particularly masochistic that night and decided to conduct these prayer services. But they would hand you a fan. Do you remember the fans? A large piece of stiffened paper, not quite cardboard, and attached to a real thin, like a popsicle stick, only thicker, right? And it would be stapled to the back, and on the front would have a picture, invariably a picture of Jesus praying in Gethsemane, and on the back with this huge advertisement for a funeral home, a nearby funeral home, right? Ah! And, you know, I'm a kid at the time, but I can read, for God's sake, and I'm sitting there, and I look at the picture of Jesus in Gethsemane. I don't know who painted it. Was it Rubens? Was it the Rembrandt? I have no idea, but, you know, it was very lush painting reproduction. And on the back, I'm reading this about cemeteries, or not cemeteries, but funeral homes. You know, I'm thinking, but they're teaching downstairs on Sunday that there is no such thing as death, that, you know, it's, well, whatever. So sitting up there, though, and listening to the prayers, and Lord have mercy, weren't they fervent prayers? It was very scary because, you know, I'm a kid. I'm a little kid. I'm, you know, 7, maybe 8. And hear them praying for, deliverance of the country, because the country was going to hell. The country was a mess. Nobody believed in this particular instance, the teachings of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Not too many people were being born again and washing in the blood, of the Lamb. I used to listen to that, and I think, I had a cousin who lived out on a farm, and I've seen what it's like during a butchering. I know. I've never seen a lamb butchered, but I saw a hog butchered one time. Not pleasant. Take a bath in it? But, I mean, that's the kind of stuff, you know, when you're 6, 7, 8 years old. And it gets you, doesn't it? It gets you. It gets you right where you live, where all that fear is and all that doubt, all that uncertainty. Well, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I wonder if Jesus is going to come. The most fun in the world to me as a thinking adult now is to go to the Rapture Ready websites and to read this stuff. I haven't been there since the attack on Libya has occurred, but I'm sure that there are people at the Rapture Ready websites who are just orgasmic again, because they think, this time for sure, oh, I got to get my makeup done and have my nails fixed, because I'm going to rise up and meet Jesus.
Is it clean as the snow? Are you
been sponsored by, and will be for another 10 minutes, Patricia Kunkel. Thank you, Patricia. We appreciate the support. Truly appreciate the support. JP in Raleigh sent me an email. He sent it last night, and I received it earlier today. He writes, Mike, good morning. I had a short remark or comment about Rick Snyder signing into law the reduction of unemployment benefits by 6 weeks in Michigan. What the blank? But despite my own anger about this from a distance, I'm in North Carolina, we have to bear in mind that this seems to be one of many recent situations in which voters can directly see what their participation or lack of it in their local political scene has brought. It also indicates that politicians are not afraid of that massive block of unemployed Americans, in this particular case, in Michigan. I can tell at least one or two reasons why they're not afraid. Number one, the unemployed are consumed with looking for work and with trying to find health care. There are county services, but they are limited and very selective. Maybe a free eye clinic that takes only diabetics, for instance. And they require lots of paperwork to be submitted for approval, or with the fear of what happens should benefits run out, evictions, and worse. Thus, they spend, the unemployed, lots of time waiting in the lobby of various agencies for help. They live without electricity or heat or both, have no phone service perhaps, and basically don't have strong advocates. Churches are overwhelmed and maybe hand out a few gift cards for the grocery store, and food stamps are not as easy to get. Neither is heat or electric help, many counties limiting help to one time only. Congress is said to cut back the low-income heat program significantly. Point is, the unemployed are more powerless than ever, and Congress knows this. Two, the Republican Party believes that it has a mandate based on who the voters put into office. But voters seem to have lost sight of the fact that they need to do their homework, if they ever did it, to make sure they are voting for solid representation and not a Chamber of Commerce guy. This is what we have now. The Chamber of Commerce guy is running things, and it goes all the way to the top. Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, and the late Joe Badgett speak to similar topics, the big American sleep and the idea that as long as we fight abortion, everything else will work out. I think we're in for a hell of a ride now, and I don't see anything yet that will put a stop to the Republican move to dismantle the country. Maybe a tipping point is near, and I can't see it. But Americans seem so damn passive, and the ones who are doing well seem to be purposely oblivious because nothing has touched them. Maybe if a few more professors lose tenure and a few million doctors go bankrupt, we might see a groundswell. But for the poor and those kicked out in the, of the middle class, these people are being vilified and disappeared quite successfully by our media and government. Looks to me like the big jobs with big money are not in the private sector these days. I will keep listening and thank you for taking the time to put a solid 3 hours together each day. And when I'm able, I will jump in with some money to support the show. JP in Raleigh, North Carolina. Joe, no problem. No problem. We certainly don't expect people who are struggling to survive to send, throw anything in the hat over here. You got to take care of what you got to take care of. But I think Joe's point, or JP's point, is it Joe or JP? What did I call him? I called him Joe. I think it's just JP. Anyway, JP's point, very simply, is something that we've talked about in this program. A lot of people have reminded me, Malloy, when you talk about revolution always comes out of the middle class. Are you serious? The middle class is exhausted. It's tired. It's unemployed. It's struggling. Well, that's true. And that's the reason for breaking the back of the middle class. Because once you break the back of the middle class, you have the slums of Buenos Aires, or the slums of Calcutta, or the slums of Detroit. You have people who are unable because they simply don't have the energy to resist in a meaningful, political, civil, disobedient way. So the whole idea of destroying the middle class is to destroy the laboratory where revolution might grow and develop. But I don't know. I don't necessarily believe that to be the case anymore. True, revolution historically has always come from the middle class, but we have social media now, don't we? Huh? We have the ability to notify literally through texts and posting and IMs, whatever you want to call it, all these different ways we can motivate, we can get together, notify 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 people. It's very simple and very easy to do. So the idea that an oppressed or a disappeared middle class guarantees that there would never, ever, ever again be a revolt against the ruling class, against the people who are literally destroying the society, is not valid anymore. It can be done. And I'm just wondering, like I always wonder, you know, what's it going to take? What is it going to take before people say, all right, that's enough? I don't know. I wish I knew. I hope I'm around when that occurs. Stay with us. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. I'm Mike Malloy. Did I say keep it lit? I'll see you tomorrow.